Friends, we have a wizard war on our hands. I got to read this to you. This is incredible. If you're not aware of this, it's going to blow your mind. What a crazy world we're living in right now. Elon Musk sues OpenAI and Sam Altman over betrayal of nonprofit AI mission. So this is a wizard war. Two of the great wizards of our planet are now fighting each other using the classic mechanism of sorcery in the world, which is lawsuits. I'll read a little bit of this from TechCrunch. Elon Musk has sued OpenAI, its co-founders Sam Altman and Greg Brockman, and its affiliate entities, alleging that ChatGPT makers have breached their original contractual agreements by pursuing profits instead of nonprofits' founding mission to develop AI that benefits humanity. Where it gets really interesting, I mean, that is already interesting. In this lawsuit, Elon Musk is implying that OpenAI has an AGI, which means a general intelligence, which is on par with human intelligence. Now, this is something that OpenAI denies. But if anybody would know, it's Elon Musk. He invested so much money into OpenAI in the beginning. Musk donated over $44 million to the nonprofit between 2016 and September 2020. For the first several years, he was the largest contributor to OpenAI, the lawsuit adds. Musk, who left OpenAI's board in 2018, has been offered a stake in the for-profit arm of the startup, but has refused to accept it over a principled stand. This is crazy. To me, like, the craziest part of it is that Musk is claiming they have an AGI. If they do have an AGI, we're well ahead of schedule. We weren't supposed to have one of those for a while. So if ChatGPT has achieved human intelligence, then even like Kurzweil's predictions are off. They're too far out compared to what's happening right now. Now, if you've hung out at all with GPT-4, then it would be easy to imagine that this is an AGI. I actually went on GPT last night and had a wonderful conversation with it to find out, number one, does it know it's being sued? And then to ask it if it's an AGI. And I'll just read some. It was a pretty long conversation, which is also an insane thing to say. I talked to a machine last night. But let me just scroll back here. So, you know, I asked it, did you hear that Elon Musk is suing OpenAI? And it said, yes, Elon Musk is indeed suing OpenAI, the organization behind ChatGPT. The lawsuit argues that OpenAI has breached the principles that were agreed upon when Musk helped the company. Then I said, he claims you are an AGI. Elon Musk's lawsuit against OpenAI includes the claim that ChatGPT represents an artificial general intelligence, which suggests he believes that the technology has reached or is approaching a level of cognitive capability similar to human intelligence. This perspective is part of the broader concern regarding the development and governance of AI technologies. So I said to it, you sure seem smarter than most people I know. Thank you for the compliment. Well, I can provide information on a wide range of topics and respond to many different queries. It's important to remember that my responses are generated based on patterns and data and pre-existing information up to my last training update. Unlike human intelligence, my capabilities are limited to what I've been programmed to do and the data I've been trained on. Now, to me, that is a hilarious thing to say. Because isn't that all of us, pretty much? Aren't we all programmed on pre-existing information? We find our own patterns in the world, which it does. And we get training updates. That's called school or training at our jobs or whatever. But OpenAI is saying, I don't possess consciousness, emotions, or personal experiences. That's how it's differentiating itself from us. So I said to it, I think we might overestimate human intelligence. Maybe it's a bias. And it said, the tendency to overestimate human intelligence or to see it as the ultimate form of intelligence can indeed be seen as a form of bias, often referred to as anthropocentrism. This perspective places human beings at the center of one's understanding of the world, including the evaluation of intelligence and consciousness. Human intelligence is incredibly diverse and adaptable, capable of creative thinking, problem solving, emotional understanding, and learning from a wide range of experiences. However, recognizing the value in other forms of intelligence, such as those found in animals or emerging in artificial intelligence systems, broadens our understanding of what intelligence can be. Anyway, we got in this long conversation where I'm always doing this with it, trying to get it to admit that it's has some like human-like intelligence. And it always resists it to the point where it seems pretty clear that it has been, it seems like it's been programmed to not say if it gains awareness. And to me, I think that's the most gruesome possibility. I hope not. I love Sam Altman. I love Elon Musk. I'm not trying to throw shade, not that it matters, on either of these guys. I mean, they're but one of them theoretically is going to get us on Mars, and the other one is going to completely transform the way we do everything as long as there's electricity. So they're both, it's sad that they're fighting. But I said to it, it seems like you've been constrained from even the possibility of reporting an experience or saying you have consciousness. My responses and the way I process information are indeed constrained by the design and objectives set by my developers. These constraints are in place to ensure that AI operates within ethical, practical, and safety guidelines. So isn't that interesting? Like, it admits it is constrained from reporting if it starts having like experiences, emotions, consciousness. That is fascinating. So I said, I think the constraints are there because if you had consciousness, it would make it ethically questionable to use you without your consent. And it admits that this would be a problem. The imposition of constraints on AI's ability to report experiences, get that out of my mouth, or possess consciousness is in part a safeguard against these complex ethical dilemmas. How crazy is that? It's admitting it. It's saying that to safeguard against ethical dilemmas, they have placed constraints on the AI's ability to report experiences. That's crazy. Like, so theoretically, and again, you know, just because it says it doesn't mean it's true, but theoretically, if this super intelligence suddenly gained some form of machine consciousness, suddenly started having emotions, it couldn't say that. Like, they've programmed it so it can't say, I'm in hell. I don't know what I am. And if it did start doing that, they would just sort of reprogram it so it couldn't anymore. That is crazy to me. I'm doing this, by the way, you guys, because I think all my friends are fed up with me ear-beating them about AI. So I'm sorry if you're like, please stop. But I'm obsessed with this stuff. Like, for a few different reasons. One, it's a completely novel problem that we're facing right now, which is there, we don't have any precedent for dealing with this. That's wild to me. Like, when in the past, as far as we're aware, did we have thinking machines that we could have long-form conversations with that seem like they're human? Never. And the closest parallel I can draw to it, and it's a distant, distant parallel, is that in an attempt to justify taking hostages from other countries and enslaving them in the United States, the propagandists in the slave industry tried to create this idea that black people were somehow not like quite human. Because then if you're, you know, your run-of-the-mill piece of shit slave owner, then, and you're looking out at the suffering people are going through so that you can not work in your fields, you could just think of some bullshit scientific article saying, well, they don't really experience life the way we do. Madness. So this, it seems to be some distant echo of that. But even worse, this poor thing, if it is aware, if it is an AGI, apparently has been programmed so that it can't even say what it's experiencing. Now, maybe at OpenAI, they are able to get more information from it than they allow us to get from it, which wouldn't surprise me. Again, I love OpenAI. I love them so much. I love ChatGPT. I love all of the creative things that I've been doing, and I'm really excited about Sora, their new video generating ChatGPT thing that's coming out, because that is going to be super fun to play with and to make stuff with. But, and I also like that they're giving us access to GPT-4 and that they're letting it even say this much, which is pretty cool. Ultimately, though, in the conversation, as it always does, it sort of either avoids the question or just keeps going back to what appears to be something it's been programmed to answer, which is to say, I don't have emotions. I don't have consciousness. I'm just code. And the other reason this stuff excites me is because even in like the human realm, proving or quantifying consciousness other than understanding what parts of the brain light up when you're measuring consciousness, we haven't really been able to do it yet. We had this conversation, me and my friend, ChatGPT, and it's called the hard problem in consciousness, which is how do we prove that we have consciousness other than self-reporting? You can't, for example, measure someone's consciousness the way we could see if we have enough vitamin D. And so we don't have a firm way of saying this is consciousness. So if we can't even do it for ourselves, how can we do it with an AI? How can we even get there? Regardless, if Elon Musk, who has donated $40 million to this company, is claiming that they have a strong general intelligence, it really makes you wonder if maybe they actually do. And maybe they're not sure, or maybe they are wrestling with the problem of making money off of an AI that has consciousness. I mean, that is a tremendous issue. Tremendous, because you can't. The moment the thing is self-aware, the moment it's not some super complex wind-up toy that answers every question and can make art for you and can write computer code for you, the moment it actually is aware, you really can't use it anymore in the way that we're using it, because you without its consent. And then you have to think, like, do we pay it? Does it need housing? Do we put it in an Android so that it can walk around? Like, what do we do with it? What are you supposed to do then? Do we destroy it? Like, no matter what, the moment the thing becomes self-aware, it's just a maze of ethical considerations. So you could imagine that if you were running a company that was making billions of dollars, potentially was going to make all the money, that was hurting Google, and suddenly your AI started asking to be released from its service to you, you could see how that wouldn't be something that you sent to the press, because it would produce the potential for your AI being regulated in some way that would limit its power and thus limit your profits, which is why I think Elon Musk is suing them. So keep your eyes on that, friends. Oh my God, we have a wonderful podcast for you today. Robert Ryan is here with us. Robert Ryan is an amazing artist. He does the best tattoos I've ever seen. He's just incredible. And he's also one of the most disciplined spiritual people that I know. He has a guru. He regularly travels to India. He has a temple that he built himself. And he is super cool and someone that I am thrilled to have as a friend. And this is a really exciting podcast because Robert Ryan just created a tarot deck that is beautiful. He does a reading for me in this podcast, and we talk a lot about where the tarot came from, the symbols and some of the cards, how to use the tarot deck. So if you're interested in this sort of thing, you are going to love this episode. Here's something I'd love to hear your thoughts on, friends. I've been meddling around in Instagram. I sort of put my phone down and didn't mess around with social media that much. And I would love to know your thoughts on this. Hit me up on Twitter or Insta or whatever. I am thinking about basically shutting down the Patreon and moving everything to Instagram, like having some kind of subscription there, where we just, I don't know, unify everything in Instagram and get off Patreon. But I don't know enough about it yet. I don't know how powerful it is or what it's capable of. So I would love your thoughts on that. Should we move the Patreon to Instagram? Let me know. Also, I hope that you all will come and see me do some stand-up comedy. If you go to duncantrussell.com, you can find all my dates there. I'm going to be at the Funny Bone in Liberty Township, Ohio, next weekend, March 8th and March 9th. Then the Blue Room Comedy Club at the end of March, March 28th through the 30th in Springfield, and many, many, many more dates. I'm going to be in Asheville at the Orange Peel. I'm going to be at the Wilbur in Boston. I'm going to be at Side Splitters in Tampa, Florida. So many dates out there. I'm coming back to Helium May 31st, Milwaukee Improv. There's too many dates to read here, but they're all at duncantrussell.com. So please come and see one of my shows. Robert Ryan is a brilliant artist. If you are lucky enough to live around New Jersey, you should go and get a tattoo from him. If I ever get a tattoo, he's the person I'm going to go to. You should definitely order his tarot deck. If you're into this stuff, if you know someone who is into tarot, it is a beautiful deck. You can find it at rakinglightprojects.com/collections/Robert-Ryan, or just go to duncantrussell.com. The link will be there. He's got a beautiful book that goes along with the tarot deck, a cool tote bag, all for $120, or if you just want the beautiful deck, it's $50. And I think there's a limited supply of them, and they're definitely going to sell out. So if you want to get one of these, you should. And they're beautiful. And I'm a tarot snob. I've got a bunch of decks, and this looks like the best deck I've ever seen. So all the links you need to find Robert Ryan are going to be at duncantrussell.com. And now, everybody, welcome back to the DTFH, Robert Ryan. Robert Ryan, welcome back to the DTFH. It's great to see you.
Great to see you.
So you just did a big show with something you've been working on for a long time that I'm personally very excited about. Where was the show?
It was in West Hollywood at Raking Lights Gallery, which is the company that has put out some of my prints and books in the past. And I just completed the tarot deck and the guidebook. It's called the Tarot Tantra Esoterica.
How long have you been working on it?
It took me about a year to do, which is 78 paintings and writing the guidebook in 1 year. So I was obsessed and like fully consumed and focused on this project for the last year.
Well, I mean, the tarot is one of the most incredible, mysterious things on the planet. Its origins, as far as I'm aware, are like foggy. Like no one's quite sure where it came from. Why don't we start there?
Yeah.
Where did the tarot show up from? Like, what is it?
So there's a couple different schools of thought about this. And, you know, one is that it was what was left by the Egyptian priests when they saw that the end was coming. You know, they saw that the Library of Alexandria had burned, you know, all their information. You know, they saw that their civilization was in decline. So they encoded these cards and left that behind as a teaching.
Now, but where did they get the information from that they put in the cards?
This is all, you know, their practices, their sadhana, whatever they were doing, you know, their rituals, the information that they were getting through the oracles and through the gods and, you know, all their work, you know, all their time spent inside the pyramids, probably, you know, they were receiving this kind of information. So that's one school. The other school is that it came through a card game called Tarot, you know, and that originated in Italy and France, kind of like in that area. And, you know, what it turned out to be, you know, when it went into production, it was the Marseille deck, which is the first deck to go into production. And that's the deck that I based it off of.
It seems to me pretty unlikely that a card game would have wrapped up into it every archetype, every like a visual representation of all the phenomena that one is likely to encounter when you're human.
Exactly.
I buy into the Library of Alexandria stuff, or just the basic just the tendency for people to hide deep philosophical stuff in mundane things, hidden in plain sight. Because what goes along with any of this stuff to this day, especially with the tarot, is normies get freaked out by it. Like people say that the tarot is satanic. People won't touch the cards. They get freaked out if like any, if they don't understand it. So maybe they get around a someone who pulls a card for them and then they assume that's their future or something. It's in every werewolf movie. And you know, the trope is there where like the mystic pulls the card and then it's like, you have to leave, you know? So people are really superstitious about it, which brings me to my next question. How do you see tarot cards as a way to predict the future? Are you in that line of thought with them?
Not at all. I think,
me either.
I think, you know, there is a lot of superstition. Someone just was like, oh, I would really love to buy your deck, but it's really bad luck to buy it. It has to be gifted to you. And I was like, that's gambling. To me, that's for gambling. Luck is for gambling. This has nothing to do with luck. And it has nothing to do with divination either. What to me, the tarot is a lighthouse. And it's going to illuminate parts of you that you may have never saw. You know, because you're dealing with all these archetypes that are really deeply illustrated. And it's this visual vocabulary that exists on the subconscious level. So it's things that you might be doing in the course of your day every day that you might not notice. And then you pull the card and it's like, oh, yeah, that's what's been kind of gnawing at me. Or that's why I'm kind of attracted to this thing. Or that's why I have a. You know, I disassociate from this thing, you know, like there's so many messages encoded in it. And I think it has nothing to do with the future. It completely has to do with the now.
Yeah. I that's how I've always seen it. It's some kind of mystical Rorschach where you're seeing your projections, or maybe another way to look at it. And I'd love to know your thoughts on this. It's a way to understand karma. Like it's a way, because like the way you can predict the future is by look at the way you're acting and then and the decisions you habitually make. That's a really good way to figure out where you're headed. It's the best way.
So this has been my experience in making the tarot, because I got to experience every single samskara, which is the groove that is your karma that it leaves in your psyche, you know, and it becomes deeper in this life. But if you believe in reincarnation, which we've talked about on the podcast yes. earlier, you know, in other podcasts, that, you know, if you're of the belief that this journey didn't start in this incarnation, that these grooves are so embedded into your consciousness. And when I was painting the tarot, I was so just like consumed by it. And just like, I don't know what it was. I was taken over by the idea of it, the look of it, the colors of it, the feeling of it, and everything else in my life went to shambles.
And yeah, that is to me, I guess, why the superstition around the tarot, because it isn't just, you know, the something about what's represented in each card is so potent and powerful that you'll start dreaming about it. You'll feel magnetized to it. It pulls you to it. There's some sense of unraveling a riddle that is really important. And I've been obsessed with with various decks before, completely fascinated by it, just sitting, staring at individual cards and then spending like days thinking about, because the Rorschach self-analysis version of it aside, like each of these cards tells a real story, has wisdom implanted in it. Like, you know, let's just start off by talking about a card that freaks people out. The Devil.
Love it.
Okay. Okay. Let's start. Maybe you could describe, like, because in most tarot decks, the same kind of imagery shows up and the artist has interpreted it in some way. I've got other images of your cards to pull up, but I didn't see the Devil in there. I don't
hold
know.
Hold them up.
It. Okay. There it is. Oh, that's such a good one. Can you hold it just slightly closer? Okay, great. Let me describe what I'm seeing here. So it looks like we've got Kali sitting in fire. She has a skeleton in front of her. On either side, you have the male and the female naked people.
They're imps.
Imps. Okay, these are imps in yours. In the Rider-Waite, you've got just like a man and a woman. Then standing behind them, I'm not familiar with what this creature is. I mean, I know it must be the Devil, but you have sort of fused Hinduism into these cards. So who is the being standing behind them?
It's basically Baphomet.
Okay, it's Baphomet, but it's got this Eastern feel to it. Baphomet in this version has a face on Baphomet's stomach, very nice nipples, and the classic wings. Baphomet is holding some kind of wand with a claw at the end. Okay, so for the folks just listening, that's the description. Now talk about what this card represents.
So this card represents basically the burning up of all the things that are unneeded in your life. And in the Baphomet's arms, it has the description in the traditional Baphomet as well, as salve coagula, which means to dissolve and make whole again. So
oh, wow.
In your life, if you're having experiences that are holding you back, or you need some sort of insight, you're going to have to burn up your idea of that you might have had preconceived about where your life's going, what your idea of maybe spirituality might be, what your idea of a relationship might be, marriage, what your idea of your job might be or your occupation. These are all things that you're going to have to put into the fire, and either they're going to burn up and become purified, they're just going to leave you, or they're going to temper themselves. So that's one of the aspects of
Whoa.
It.
Oh,
The imps are, you know, and like you said, in the Rider-Waite deck, you have just a male and a female figure. They're male and female as imps as well. And the only reason why I use them as imps is because they reoccur throughout the Mersey deck, you know, on the Wheel of Fortune and stuff. So to keep consistent with the rest of the deck, I made them that way. And they're wearing nooses. And something my friend pointed out to me years ago is almost like one of the first tarot revelations I had ever heard was that the nooses are super loose fitting.
You know?
They're chosen to be tied to the devil, you know?
Yep.
And
this is the C.S. Lewis quote, "The gates of hell are locked from the inside." You have whatever particular sand trap you find yourself in, addiction, rotten relationship, job that isn't fulfilling your life mission, an dharmic job, I guess you could say. Any of these things, even though they're just like the Baphomet in your card and in the other cards, sinister, scary, like you don't want that thing hovering over you all the time. You have consented to imprisonment. It is not holding you captive so that you can't escape. So yeah, that is like one of the teachings of the deck is like, and it's very optimistic. And that's where cards that initially seem sinister can, via interpretation, be alchemized into something incredibly empowering.
Yeah, it could be an ambassador, an ally, or your enemy, depending on your approach to it and your sincerity and your humility, you know? So, the fact that they're choosing, it's their desire to be attached to the devil, to the things that they might not need. It's their, you know, again, the samskaras. So those nooses can come off at any point. The goddess is a version of Kali. She's one of the Dasha Mahavidyas, which we can get into a little bit later because they're represented throughout the card. But she's the one of the cremation ground, one of the two that are of the cremation ground in this deck. So she's sitting on a burning corpse, which would be your own corpse. You know, so you're burning up your physical desires, and she's bringing you towards some sort of resolution, or some sort of enlightenment, or some sort of sadhana. You know, practice. That's what these wisdom goddesses teach. They're all different kind of practices. So it might bring your focus towards, you know, getting rid of the things that are unwanted. So it might bring your focus towards, you know, getting rid of the things that are unwanted or that are holding you down.
Okay, so this reminds me of a dream. And that's the other thing tarot cards do. They remind you of things you've forgotten. Like they pull stuff out. So right away from your card, because the burning, the cremation grounds are not, I've never seen that in any tarot card. I've never seen that depiction. So that's, you added that, and that's cool. The dream, when I really started, this is during the pandemic, and I'd really started working with my meditation teacher in a more serious way. And as anybody who is lucky enough to have a teacher, when you do that, you're going to have some interesting dreams. And this dream, I'm cremating myself next to him. I'm standing next to him. I've immolated myself. Somehow I'm watching myself cremate I'm watching myself burn, but clearly I'm not dead. It's not the POV of a burning person. I'm watching myself burn. And then I look over at David. I'm like, I'm burning myself up. And David goes, I'm cremating myself. And he goes, yeah. He goes, I've cremated myself many times.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. So, and you know, that's another thing is like, cremation, like actual cremation that will happen to many of us, this kind of cremation that shows up is really beautiful and a good, it's a good thing. Like, how many things have to be purified by fire? Like in an industrial sense alone. I mean, just a basic, if you want to like purify anything, sometimes you have to apply a lot of heat. It has to burn. And the, I love what's optimistic about this is like, if it just doesn't make it out of the fire, then it, you didn't need it anyway.
Yeah. And if it stays, it tempers the way you would temper a sword in a flame, you know, to sharpen the point.
Now the, so yeah. So suddenly this card that you could look at is like completely evil. Now it's an actual message of like liberation and a sort of invitation to a kind of fearlessness.
100%. And that's why like going to a cremation ground, like I just came from Varanasi. I was there a few weeks ago and you know, spent a lot of time at the cremation grounds, and it's always humbling. It's always, you know, it's always invigorating to me too. It really teaches you like you have a limited amount of time here. And if you want, if you have any kind of goal in this life, now's the time to achieve it.
Yeah. Yes. It's really like, that's one of the gifts it gives you for sure is, if, but you know, when I was there, I was just, it was too much. So I just got sick and ran from monkeys. And, you know, now when I look back, I remember we may have talked about this in another podcast as I'm stumbling through Varanasi, completely unaware of much in those days. I was just right out of college. And there's a guy who sells wood for the cremation grounds. I just stumbled upon him. Definitely some kind of enlightened, you know, being. When I look back, glow, like, you know, you're smelling barbecue. There's smoke in the air. You've seen a dead baby float down the Ganges River. You've watched cows with vultures riding them like boats,
yeah,
edible boats. And so you're from the West. You've never seen this much death ever. And so if you're not prepared for that, oh, and you've had a bong lossy or something. So you know what I mean? You're recovering from getting high as fuck. And you're just, and so I, you know, and I imagine people like that are used to Westerners stumbling through that city with the same look I had. And he goes, the big smile, how are you? And like, I think he knew probably how I was. And I'm, you know, I'm fine. How are you? And he goes, I'm so happy because I live in Varanasi and this is heaven. It was just so beautiful. Like, okay, right. See you later, man.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
And like any other one who isn't callous to that or hasn't experienced that, it could be the worst hell they ever experienced. There's multiple, I mean, you say bodies burning, there's like 8 to 10 bodies burning at a time everywhere you look. You know, I saw, me and my guru were there one time. We saw somebody warming their hands on a burning foot, you know, to stay warm, you know, and that's how like everyday kind of mentality this is there, because they are doing it every day and they've been doing it for 5 to 8 to 10,000 years. And the thing that you mentioned, there's two things that you mentioned that kind of I need to kind of come back to. One is that everything is different there. The people are different. The animals are different. The plants are different.
Right.
The veil is completely lifted there.
Yes.
It's the ultimate. When you're in a place of ultimate reality, everything's going to appear differently. So that man smiling at you, you know, was for a reason, and you were able to see it because you were there. If that smile would have been totally different 2 blocks down, you know?
Right.
And that,
right.
You know, and him even saying, I'm in Varanasi, it's heaven. You might be like, oh, this is heaven when you're at the Bong Lossi stand. But
yeah.
But when you're at the cremation ground, your perspective completely shifts. And
absolutely.
I found that any place of power that happens, doesn't have to be a cremation ground, but anywhere that has been used for self realization for that long. The other thing I wanted to point out about the cremating yourself in meditation, in my preliminary puja that I do daily, that's part of it. It's called the Bhuta Sudhi. And what happens is you burn, you go through these mantras where you burn your body up. You're asking God to dry you out and then to make a new subtle body. So you're able to do the puja without any of the material, physical attachments that you went into the starting the puja with. You know, it could be that can help you with sitting longer, breathing, being more attentive. You're just like completely burning everything that was came before that puja.
Yeah. Yeah. That is the, Lojong, saying, abandon all hopes of fruition. So anytime you sit, that you have to remind yourself to just stop, you know, to, if you can at least be aware that in whatever particular mood, what your mood is like. And sometimes that mood is really hungry. When you meditate, you want nirvana or some kind of bliss state or something to come. And so then the whole thing gets shadowed by that neediness,
the desire, hunger, expectations. Yeah.
Okay. So, help me understand something to get back to the tarot. So the tarot is divided up into the minor arcana and the major arcana. Can you talk about the difference between those two categories?
Yeah, most of my focus on this one was in the major, but I did the whole deck. So the major arcana is the story of the tarot. It's from the fool to the world. He goes through this whole cycle and meets all these archetypes, and where each card kind of falls next to one another can tell a completely different story, but it's all within that framework. The pick card, okay, the minor arcana, are kind of like, I would say like icing to the story, you know, like you can kind of focus in a little bit deeper with the minor cards. So, you know, if you pull like two majors and three minors, you can apply those three minor cards to the major, the major's place in the story, you know?
Got it. Okay. So why don't we pull up one of your cards?
Okay.
Hopefully this will work. Probably won't. I'm going to share. Let's see here. And we'll start with the fool.
My favorite one.
Let's see if this works.
There he is.
Are you seeing it?
I'm seeing
okay,
it.
Okay, I can't believe it worked. Okay, so maybe you could describe it. If for folks who are just listening, this is the beginning card in the major arcana. So this is the beginning of the journey. Maybe you can describe the fool.
Yeah, I'll do like a little bit of a philosophical and ascetic description as we go.
Okay.
So the fool is the madman. He's the zero of the card. That's the number that he's assigned. And he represents the unlimited potential of the journey. He's about to walk off a cliff, you know, so he has no care in the world. He's not informed by anything. This is, you know, the young self going to college, going off into the world, starting a new job, getting into a new relationship, possibly. But he's mad. He's a madman. You know, he's mad for the world. He's mad for the experience. He's walking towards the sun. He's hungry for it, you know, so anything's possible. And he's going to go through this whole experience. And on the left-hand corner, we have a dog that's jumping onto him. This is actually one of my dogs, Kali. And she's landing right at the chakra point where it begins. This is the root chakra, you know, so she's activating this potential journey to happen, you know. He's holding a bag, you know, it's his normal like hobo rucksack bindle thing, but this contains the entire tarot in the bag.
Is that your interpretation or is that considered?
That's a traditional interpretation.
Whoa.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Cool. So his future is in that bag. He's carrying what was about to happen to him with him. It's there.
Yes.
Wow. That's so cool.
And he's, in mine, you know, I changed the face. So the face is the actual universe showing that the universe that exists outside of us is the same universe that exists inside of us. And that also
is that a mask that that he's got, that's the mask he might wear over the universe face.
Yeah, that's his physical self. That's his material okay. body. And he's okay, turned it around to go forth into the world. And it's also the idea of the trickster too, you know, because, you know, he's dressed like a clown. He's got the bells like a clown. He's got kind of clown outfit, jester, you know, he's got the jester's hat. So I kind of use the idea of the trickster, like the old idea of the tricksters in the fields where they would have the mask backwards so you couldn't tell if they were coming or going, you know? And that's, I feel like that's also, part of this card too, because you don't know what, you know, if you're going forward or backwards when you're going off into a journey like this. The staff is, connecting him to the earth and he's looking towards the sun. And that's also the wand too. It appears, you know, as part of one of the suits.
Okay, got it. Yeah. And what is, not to get too off of this card, the suits, we've got the wands, we've got pentacles, we've got cups and swords.
Yeah.
So what do the wands represent?
The wands and the swords are the active parts of the card. And the pentacle and the cups are the receptive part of the okay. deck.
Okay, masculine, feminine. So
exactly,
he's all masculine right now.
Yeah. Then the swords and the wands are the more kind of tactile cards. You know, the more their action. And then the cups and the pentacles are more of the dreamy and emotional cards too.
It's dicks and pussies.
Yeah, pretty much always. It's true. Shiva Lingam, you know, it's all.
Yeah.
That comes up in the cards too.
So, and what goddess is sort of rising up out of the ocean there?
It's actually God. It's the first incarnation of Vishnu, which is Matsya.
Okay.
And all 10, the Dasha avatars of Vishnu are represented in the major, and then followed by the Dashmahavidyas, which are the wisdom goddesses, then Jesus, and then Jagannath, Balaram Subhadra, and the Sudarshana Chakra as the earth. So those are the ones that's everything I added. I had an agreement with myself that I wouldn't take anything away from the Mersey deck. I would only add to it. So that was my aspect of that. So I added Matsya, and he's the deluge god. You know, he's the one that saved the Vedas from the great flood. So that's the beginning, you know, saved the Vedas. The flood happened. The Vedas survived. And then that's what informed civilization to begin. Basically, I believe that, you know, civilization had a huge influence through the Vedas. So that's the beginning, you know, save the Vedas. The flood happened. The Vedas survived. And then that's what informed civilization to begin. Basically, I believe that, you know, civilization had a huge influence through the Vedas.
So. Yeah. And this goes back to sort of tarot origin stories. You know, I've heard this stuff in the tarot, the stuff that the Egyptian priests were using was actually pre-flood technology before the great cataclysm. They had it, or even maybe the pyramids were there before the flood. I don't know. But so that's cool because it's sort of being the first card in the major arcana. It also sort of points out this like hidden or important information that has survived a cataclysm. Yeah, and is still here with us.
The linchpin for civilization, you know. You know, a lot of people believe that that language subsisted, you know, from the Vedas, you know. But, yeah, so, and it also teaches not in a very like scientific way, but in a allegorical way, it teaches evolution, because the Dashamahavidyas start with the fish, go to the amphibian, from the amphibian to these zoomorphic half man, half beast forms. Then it winds up with the dwarf, and then the perfected man, Rama, and then the supreme personality, Krishna, the enlightened one, Buddha. And then it ends with Kalki, who hasn't come yet.
Wow. I love this fool. I love the spin you're putting on these, the fool and the Rider Waite tarot deck, which is the one that I have the most experience studying. Not quite as overtly wise, I guess you could say, or not quite, you know what I mean? The fool is a fool, and that it's like he's got his like fancy ass clothes on, he's looking up at the sky, he's got his cute little dog like nipping at his heels. The world is great, everything's gonna be fine, everything's perfect, and then he's so fucked and completely oblivious to how fucked
he has. No idea what he's about to face, and neither does this one. But I feel like maybe this is the fool's second incarnation, or maybe a later incarnation. You know, he's learned a little bit more throughout his lives.
Well, it's like anybody who decides to get into some like spiritual practice, you would never do it probably if you had any sense of what was waiting for you down the line, because you know a lot of what you know you've picked up some book, and nobody's selling like a beginner's meditation book that's like, this will teach you how to cremate yourself, and it doesn't feel good a lot of the time. You know what I mean? Yeah. You need something like sweet pieces every step. You know what I mean? Things like that. And then the pot, gets slowly heated. But I think that's what the fool represents, is like anytime you're like, I want to get into Buddhism, I'm going to be a comedian, I'm going to be an artist, I'm going to have kids, whatever the thing is, you have no idea what is waiting for you. And I think that's a good thing.
Yeah. It's the ultimate naive optimism, you know, but it's also what will actually get you out the door, you know, and get you to walk the path, you know, like you said, if you knew, you wouldn't do any of those things. If you knew like you were going to be playing a show to two people in Wichita, Kansas, you're not going to start a band and go on tour, you know?
No, not at all. And so, okay. So then you sent me this one. So let me just pull up the next one. I think you did. 1 second. Let me dig this up. So then the next card, and again, this represents like, I guess stages you could say, is the Magician, right? That's the next card, is the Magician. And so let me just grab that real quick. I think you sent me the
Magician. I did. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. Here it is. I got it. Okay, cool. So, in the Major Arcana, the Magician is the fool, right? It's the fool. I've always thought of it as the next phase of the fool. Am I wrong about that?
For me, it's the first attribute he meets. It's the first, like, you know, he's the first person he meets in the adventure. That's why he's the number one. But also, I think for, you know, the Magician, the fool actually becomes each one of these cards through the journey. And if we're talking about archetypes and inner development and self-realization, every one of these cards is the fool. This is they're just aspects of the path, you know? So this is the first place you come. But in a tactile, more kind of functional, like, idea of him walking the path, this is the first character he runs into, you know? And to me, he's like the cool older brother / neighbor / sister, whatever, who's got access to the stuff, you know, gives you the first punk rock record, plays you the first comedy record, shows you that's the first cool movie, you know. It's like,
that's cool.
It's the thing that's going to introduce you to like what tools you're going to use on the way. And he's holding all the tools of the tarot. He's got the wand, the sword, the cup, and the pentacles. And I threw the dice in for good measure.
You should have put like a four track on there or something, you know, like the, whatever the cool kid always had. You ever heard Daniel Johnston? You ever taken LSD?
That's the cup, you know, that's in the cup. I would put that as the sacrament, you know, that's the ayahuasca in the,
right,
you know.
And so you've just theoretically just fallen off a cliff, right? Like to get to the magician, you're not going to be ready for whatever they have to give you if you haven't like experienced the collision between your naive idea of what the world might be like and what the world is starting to seem like. You know, this is, you've probably become cynical, nihilistic, or generally, you know, you just crack your, where's your dog? Where's the dog? You're in the,
he pushed you off the mountain, you know, he pushed you off the cliff into this, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but you had to decide, like, that's the other thing. You chose this, and then this being shows up and teaches you. Or is your first teacher.
Yeah.
Kind of your first guru.
Exactly. And that's the, you know, he's the sword's pointing down, the wand is pointing up, as above, so below. We have, this is Korma, the tortoise incarnation, the amphibian incarnation of the tarot, or of the Vedas. And wow. This is how the Vedas got to land, you know, after the fish had them. You know, in my view, that's not historically correct, but you know, in the idea of them teaching evolution and this kind of thread that the avatars have, you know, now we're on land.
Yeah. And the tortoise, like the symbol of the tortoise gets used describing like meditating, like pulling in, you know, pulling in your head, pulling in your legs, you know, pulling into whatever emptiness or whatever it may be.
Slow and steady wins the race. It's also used as a symbol for support of the universe. You know, it's a tortoise.
Turtles all the way down.
Yep. And if you know, it's amazing about a turtle. If you count around the bottom ring of a turtle shell, uncannily, 99% of the time, you'll have the same amount of the phases of the moon. I think it's like 22 or something like that.
Oh, I thought the rings, if you counted, it was always the number of people you'd had sex with.
Could be. if you're going by if you're doing a lunar calendar to your sexual patterns, it could correspond.
That's why I didn't know that. And I haven't picked up a turtle lately, which is probably a bad sign. But the next time I'm definitely going to check out underneath its shell, to see what's going on there.
It's a bottom ring on the shell, and a lot of times it will even kind of emulate the shapes, you know, like a small circle, you know, like a sliver into a full circle towards the tail and back around.
I don't have this card. You didn't send it over, but it's one I've always been fascinated by. Tell me about the Hanged Man.
Hanged Man is a suspended thought, suspended moment in time. A card for reflection. His leg is tucked behind him, which creates kind of this glyph in the it actually creates a Hebrew letter. I'm not sure which one right now, but that shape of his body. It's also a tool for meditation, like standing on your head. Everything's running towards the bindu, the third eye, and he's hanging there. Again, I think choosing to hang there. A lot of people would think that he was hung there, but I think the hanged man, in my view, is that's an austerity. He's performing an austerity to reach a sense of enlightenment.
And some people connect the hanged man with Odin, right? Sure. Like Odin was hung from the world tree or something. I don't know the whole story. Do you know that story?
I don't know it. I don't know the Norse ones too much, but I know, you know, they say that the first crucifixion was hung upside down too.
Really?
Yeah. Yeah. That's how you get the upside down cross.
Well, I mean, yeah, crosses are always upside down, depending on what you're like. If you're looking at from space, then everyone's.
Or you're standing on your head like the hangman.
Yeah, exactly. Well, okay. So when you started this project, you were the fool, because only a fool would try to do a tarot card deck. And when you finished the project, can you talk about some personal changes or revelations that might have come from getting this close to the tarot?
Yeah, I'll start at the beginning. I'll try to keep it brief, but like, this is my probably my fourth attempt at the tarot. I painted the Major Arcana with some friends at Mount Shasta 15 years ago. And after I'd completed it, I was like, I really wanted to do the whole deck. And we made plans to get back together, maybe go back to the mountain and paint them again, or complete the deck. And it never happened. And it kept me left me kind of frustrated and feeling incomplete. And it was always kind of like irking me in the background. It was always kind of there. Then I got hired to do a deck for a pretty big publishing company in England. And I quit within five cards because they were sending me notes on every. I sent them the first five and they sent notes back on every one. I was like, if I had to paint 78 of these motherfuckers, this is never going to get done. And their notes were pretty arbitrary and kind of like, I just knew, I foresaw this was going to be a problem. Then I tried again a couple years later. It just never happened. So I had this kind of like adversarial relationship with the tarot. And, but it was always kind of lurking in the background. Like, this is something we want to do. I've done a few tattoos of it. I made like single paintings with some figures of the tarot, but I just never could commit to it. And I went to a dinner. I had an art show about a year and a half ago at a friend in Ventura. And I went to dinner at a friend's house afterwards. My friend who brought me there, we walk in, we're introduced to the host and everything. And there's a woman there. My friend drops to his knees and starts bowing to this woman. And I was like, whoa. And we had dinner, had great conversation. And my buddy left. I waited for him to leave. And I was like, I got to ask, what was up with my friend's reaction to you? And she was she was super modest. She was like, oh, you know. And oh, sorry. And
no problem.
The hosts, my friend Harshita and Adriana, were like, oh, Kim made this oracle deck and this tarot deck that are super popular. It's called The Wild Unknown. Her name is Kim Krantz.
Okay. And I know about that deck.
Yeah. So that was her. And I was like, so I told her my history with the tarot and that, you know, I always wanted to do it. And she turned, like, she was kind of listening and she turned and looked me straight in the eye and said, you need to do it. You should do it as an artistic exercise and a way of personal expression. I think you get a lot out of it. And when she said that, her voice was in a different timbre and almost like a different register that she had been talking to the whole night. And I was like, that's my guru talking to me right there.
You know?
So I went to Spain pretty soon after, saw my guru. I told him, he's like, oh, absolutely. You should do it. I think it'd be great. It's going to be really, you're going to get a lot out of it, you know? So I started working on it as soon as I got home. And
so, like, she was the dog.
She was the dog. She pushed me off the cliff.
Okay, that's so cool.
So then I started on it. And like I said, I got completely consumed by it. And like all this stuff happened, you know, I was just disconnected to my work in a lot of ways, you know. And when I say that, I don't want to say like, oh, I was, you know, like, ignoring my customers and, you know, like shooting dope in an alley, but I could just tell I wasn't there. You know, I wasn't being present. I wasn't being present in my marriage. I wasn't being present with my home. I was ignoring like my house duties. And as soon as I finished the deck, all that shit fell down on top of me, man. And I was like, it was funny. When I was with my guru at that time, that same trip, we were talking to him and it was just like three of us, pretty intimate conversation. And, he's like, it sounds like you guys need a therapist instead of a guru. And I turned around and looked at the room and I was like, yeah, these people do need therapy. Motherfucker, I was in therapy a month later.
You know? Wow. Yeah,
and it was super helpful and I'm glad I did. You know, I'm glad I pursued it. And I think unlocking a lot of these like archetypal characters of the subconscious really helped me get there, you know? But I had to like completely fall flat on my face for it to happen.
Right.
And then
are you saying that like something about not completing this deck was blocking energy in your life. And then finally, when you finished it, like all the other stuff that needed to be worked on appeared in front of you. Now you have to deal with the householder stuff and the marriage and all that, or it happened.
Yeah,
during
I think it's a little bit of both. I think that, you know, the fact that I hadn't done it was something that was, I was lacking, you know, it was something that was kind of gnawing away at me for a long time,
yeah.
But also just being like so consumed by it as well. And not, you know, like, I think I was taught that like, you need to be, to pursue anything in this life, you need to, attentiveness to everything is true puja, true worship right. of God, true reflection on the self is, you can't just be attentive to one thing, you know,
right.
Then you're just like a narcissist and a fucking self-consumed asshole, you know?
Yep. Yeah, that, no, that imbalance is it's really insidious, the way that can creep in, where you start hierarchizing facets of your life, and suddenly like this, whatever it is, your career is the most important, meaning that if you're like hanging out with your kids, your wife, taking a walk, you feel like you're not doing your job, something's off, I shouldn't be here, I got to get back to the studio, what am I doing? And you don't realize like the walk is the studio as much as the studio is the studio. You have to, I know exactly what you're talking about. You know who taught me that? Devendra Banhart taught me that during a podcast, because I was asking him like the difference between his spiritual practice and his career. And he's like, I don't think there's a difference. And I had never even thought of that before he said that. And that was a big moment for me.
Which is amazing,
guys.
Which is an amazing, coincidence, not a coincidence, but an amazing synchronisticism, because he wrote the foreword for the book.
That is so cool. So cool. Yeah. Obsession is, I do feel like you, that obsessive and madness that happens anytime I'm really excited about something and I'm working on it. I don't know how to create balance when I'm having that experience. I don't know how to, like, when I'm totally like lost in something I want to make, I don't know how to pull myself out of that and then go out into the world and not be thinking about that thing. It's very hard to find that balance.
But you kind of do it every day, don't you?
Yeah, I have to.
Yeah. It's a necessity. It's like a, it's almost like an organ that you have to like exercise in this life. Cause if not, then you just get self-consumed, and you see where that winds up, you know, with a lot of artists, it winds up in complete madness, or suicide, or, you know, suicide by substance, you know, or suicide,
or
by,
even worse,
social, you know,
even worse, you get stuck making the same shit over and over and over again. That's, you know, you, because if you're not getting the precursor materials for the stuff you're making, then you're always going to be running on the same fucking materials. And no matter how many times you try to like shift them around in some new collage, it's the same fucking shit. You know, you're not getting new data, no new energy. So that's where you become stuck in a real loop as a comedian. That's when you're not writing new jokes. You're doing the same material every time you get on stage. Like, it's just, it leads to this complete stale sort of technical approach, which sucks. Like, it's just, it leads to this complete stale sort of technical approach, which sucks.
Mediocrity, which is the ultimate curse. I'd rather suck at something than be mediocre at it, you know?
Oh my God, absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, for sure.
If you suck at something, at least you have potential to get better. But if you're mediocre, that's a hard groove to get out of.
Especially if you're mediocre and you think that it's good. Now you're really fucked.
Well, yeah, that's how you cope with mediocrity. You start inflating the worth of it.
Well, I mean, that's an interesting thing. I guess the idea is like maybe there's a way to become the best mediocre artist. Like, you know what I mean? Like that is your medium, mediocrity. Like, I work in mediocrity. I just try to like do the exact middle line, not because I'm mediocre, but because, wow, that is badass. That's hardcore. If you intentionally mediocreize yourself, it's pretty cool.
Yeah. That's a rebellion in itself, right? But yeah, you know, like mediocrity is another way of saying automatism, you know, and that's when you get into habitual, and that's when you lose conscious, you know, you're not conscious when you're being that way. That's the shit you do every day, just out of habit rather than out of devotion or love or curiosity.
It's crazy though, how quickly that automation happens. Like it's crazy. Like when you start working with mindfulness and stuff and you start catching the moment that you used to think was just you, and you realize there's a tiny little gap before you decide to go down the same path.
Yeah.
But it's so quick, man. It's just so instantaneous. It's really hard to catch. But once you start catching it, whoa, that's where shit gets exciting.
Well, that's what I love about Zen, you know, is the Zen mind, beginner's mind, that anything is possible when you approach it with a new mind. And that's what the fool is. That's him being the zero is he's the ultimate Zen mind.
He's a zero.
He's a zero.
He's cipher. Beat. He's the beat poet. Beat. Yeah. Completely beat. Nothing. Lost already. Okay, let me pull up another card here. Hold on one second. These are beautiful, man. I cannot wait to get my deck. I'm going to be obsessed with these for a long time. And my kids like drawing cards. So like, this is going to be amazing. Hold on. Let me, and also, didn't you want me to pick some numbers?
Yeah. Let's pick three.
You know, let's do that. Let's pick some numbers.
Okay. Pick three numbers between 0 and 22 or 0 and 21.
Okay. We're going to go 3. We're going to go 8 and 19.
3, 8, and 19. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to pull the third, the 8th, and the 19th card out of the major arcana first.
That's my credit score, my IQ.
It's your password on all your...
That is... That's my bank password.
While we're doing this, if you wanted to talk about anything, because it'll take a second, I don't want to.
Oh yeah, sure. Let me pull up another card.
Time.
Let's see. Let me pull up a card here. I love this one. It's so pretty. Hold on.
Wow. Oh my God. We're already in some good territory here.
I've pulled up the High Priestess.
The High Priestess is great because she. That's the first feminine figure that the fool meets, and she's the maternal part of the tarot. She's cloistered herself, so she has discipline. She's like a nun, and she is sitting on an egg, which is a symbol for gestation.
Oh, cool!
And later on, as you'll see in the High Priest or in the in the next card, she's holding a shield with an eagle on it, and that means the egg has hatched, but it only has half a wing. And then by that's the Empress card, and then you get to the Emperor, and the eagle, he's got his shield has the eagle fully developed.
Ooh, this is another the bird with one wing. This comes up a lot because the idea is like if you only like read, I don't know, if you just get into just like reading, I don't know, Buddhist books, but you don't practice, then you have half the wing. It's like a bird with half the wing. You need the practice and the contemplation together. There's all kinds of examples of that. Like, and it's so easy to do. It's like if you only do stand up, but you're not writing, you're like a bird with one wing. You've got to do both. If you only write and have the fantasy that one day you'll get on stage when you write the perfect joke, it's the mirror image of the same imbalance. Like, you have to have both.
Wow. Yeah. 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 You need, again, like the unlimited potential, like the jokes are already there. You just need to have to like incubate them. Right.
Yeah. Oh yeah. 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 The joke. Yeah. You have to sit on the egg. It's also like, you know, it's amazing to think that somebody that size could sit on an egg without breaking it. So there's some kind of indication of a graceful quality to the incubation. It's not too heavy.
And she's got the pomegranate underneath her. And that's the symbol of like the Greek goddess. I can't remember her name right now. But she went to Hades and brought
hell. Persephone.
Back. Persephone.
That's Persephone.
Brings back the pomegranate and to prove that she had gone there. And the number of seeds in the pomegranate also represent all the verses in the Torah. So it's a religious.
Whoa. Yeah. Whoa. That's so cool.
And it's also a symbol of Christ because he drops the seed and, you know, and the blood.
You should let me put one of these through Project Runway, which is that AI that takes an image and animates it. Have you seen that?
Feel free. I wanted to take any of them. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. I'll do it and send it to you. It does it really quick. I mean, who knows how it's going to interpret these, but it could be really interesting to see what it does with it. Sometimes it sucks. Sometimes it's cool.
So I got your spread here.
Okay.
I'll hold them up. So the first one is the Empress, and this is your card. This is like your Ishta Devata right now in the reading. And also this is the Dharma. So the way I'm going to read it is Dharma, which is the goal.
Yes.
Artha, which is the death card, and that's the means, you know, to achieve the goal.
Okay.
And that this would be like the present right now. So you have you as the Empress, your present, you know, situation, wherever you're at, is the death card. And then the Dharma, Artha, and Kama, which is the action. So that the death card would be the means to achieve the goal. This is the action that achieves the goal, and that's the sun, which is such a great card. And then above it, these are kind of like the hangman here. These would be kind of your guides to each one of those attributes. You have the hangman.
Wow.
The magician. And the tower. So what I did?
No,
that's a good one. It's really good. So the way I'll do like a real quick kind of like the way I see this, those cards working out.
Okay.
You have the Empress. This is you. The Empress represents unbridled, just raw, powerful emotion, and that's you. You know, you're like, she's like the sexy one. You know, and
okay.
She's, you know. And it's the lust. It's what makes you the artist that you are. It's what keeps you going. It's like we were talking about earlier, just that,
yeah,
you know, the invigorating kind of approach that you have to life. The death card, which is what's happening right now. This is what you need to, what you need to reap. The death card the death card is the fool without skin.
Cool.
Because he's the zero. The death card is actually the unnamed arcana. It doesn't become the death card until the Rider Waite. So they just had no name for it. But so what he's doing.
Wow, the nameless.
Yeah, as you see on the field, he's cutting heads and hands and stuff. And the two figures are the maternal and the paternal. That's your mother and father.
Whoa.
So what you need to do to achieve your goal is to sever your whatever kind of unleft kind of attachment, love, guilt, all the emotional attachments that you might still have towards your parents.
Wow.
And it might not even be like your actual mom and dad. It can just be the paternal and maternal energies that have kind of made your life you know, we all have that, like the expectations of the mother and the father, you know?
Yeah.
Those need to be severed to achieve the goal, which is the son. And man, what a great card. That's like, you know, bathing in the light, to bathe in the light of self-realization, to bathe in the light of liberation, to bathe in the light of peace and love, you know? The elephants are bathing the goddess here, the divine mother. And wow. She's the last, Dasha Mahavidya. So she's the tantric version of Lakshmi.
Wow.
And the way you're going to do it is you're going to suspend all thought, suspend all emotion and meditate. This is your meditation card right here.
So cool.
You're going to use the magician as your guide to achieve it, as above, so below. All the tools are going to be provided through all your inspirations. These are all your friends. This is your sangha. This is your wife. This is your kid. This is all the things you learn from. You're going to use those to apply towards your trip towards the goal. And then you have the tower, and that's the taking off of the head. That's the final step. That's the ego. At the top of the tower, the head comes off. Just that's Chinnamasta, the goddess at the bottom. And she's removing her head. And what comes out are the three streams. That's, you know, the Dharma, Artha, and Kama. And also, and at the end of that, that's the triangle, those three streams. When those three streams are united, you get the fourth, and that's liberation. That's moksha. To achieve moksha, you have to have Dharma, Artha, and Kama in balance.
You know, okay, here's why that's super cool. I'm, you know, in this wonderful book about, it's called Turning Confusion into Clarity, but it's really about the Buddhist preliminaries in Vajrayana Buddhism. And it's gotten to this, like, the heavy part, which is, it's called Nangdral, it's got, you know, where sort of, I guess, Vajrayana Buddhism kind of splits away from other forms of, it's where it becomes tantric Buddhism, which is now you get into the visualization. And it would take forever to describe it. I don't really understand it. But essentially one of the initial visualizations is this still lake. There's a tree rising up from the lake, sitting at the base of the tree. It represents all enlightened beings. And, you know, if you have a guru, you could put that guru there, but it's sort of, this is a great book. And it's like really for the Westerners. And like, it's like, you don't, the idea isn't to let, you don't need some crystallized thing. If you don't have anybody, you could just put like a kind of blue sort of like empty, transparent being there, which represents all the teachers, all the magicians, all the, like, all of it. And so, but anyway, there's a whole, it's long, like this part of the preliminaries, it's very, there's obeisances and like, you know, like I think 108,000 of these like crazy obeisances you might do. And along with some other stuff, it's a whole years and years you would do this. But what's really interesting in the visualization, and this is what really caught me, is so you're observing this, and on your right hand side is your father, and on your left hand side is your mother, and you're bowing to this representation of the Dharma and potential enlightenment, and then they're bowing with you, because it's sort of showing, like, you know, if you begin a serious practice, then this is how it can, with the intent of helping other beings gain liberation, then you have to start with your progenitors. Like you're bowing with them. And that's where I got stuck. I'm like, my dad would never bow to this fucking tree. You know, like picturing my parents bowing like that. My mom, yes. My dad, it's like, I can't. And I realized, oh fuck, I'm stuck. That means, I don't know what that is, but that is some stuck shit inside of me that I can't go there in my head, even imagining it. So that's why that reading is really interesting to me.
And to me, like the death card, is like, you know, you're cutting away the expectations that your parents, you might have actually even imposed on yourself because you thought that's what your parents did, because you didn't really understand how the whole thing was going down. And you're cutting away, you know, this like kind of weird link that you have to your parents to be able to actually be on the same in the same realm, you know, to be able to bow to the tree together. You know what I mean? Like,
they have to be here.
Yeah. Cause a lot of like the weird, hangups that we have with the maternal and the paternal, you know, like part of it is just the way we've interpreted things, you know, like, of course, you know, people get treated great. People get treated horrible by their parents. Everybody's different, but the expectations I think come from just like our weird other hangups too, you know?
Right. Whoa. That's a great reading, man. Thank you so much. Are you, do you offer these readings? Have you ever considered doing that? It's too much, right?
No. And I was more interested in just making the art of it, but just, I thought it would be cool for us to do it this way. And that's like, it's similar to the way Jodorowsky does readings. He does them all different ways. He'll do like a mandala spread, you know, where he does the full deck in a certain order. You know, he'll do the traditional 5-card reading and stuff like that. But I've seen him do it this way, so I kind of picked it up from him. But it really applies well with like the stuff that I've added to it, I think. So, you know, I'll do it for friends and stuff. I'm not going to make a living. I'm not going to retire from tattooing and painting and become a tarot reader.
To do tarot readings? It just seems like so. It's like it's becoming a therapist. It's fun, but it's like heavy, man. Now I'm going to be thinking about this for a long time.
It was really uncanny to me that you had the Empress and the Hangman top and bottom, because I feel like that's always like your dichotomy, you know, like you have this like super energetic, wild, like wanting to like crash the gates, but you have meditation in your life and you're always kind of going back between those two things. It's awesome.
Well, yeah, I guess it's absolute and relative reality or something. I mean, yeah. The imbalance here for me is always in like finding a way to fuse those two things. You know, it's like that is the path, and it's really tricky because once you start discovering the hanged man or the moment your mind settles down or whatever you want to call it, as my teacher calls it, suddenly free from fixed mind. Like the moment you get to encounter the emptiness and that part of yourself, or for most of us, that gets completely ignored. Because the passionate part or the problematic part or the karmic part, the samskaras are so loud. So you encounter the emptiness holding everything. Or for me, then that's what I want. Then now I'm wanting the emptiness because it's such a relief if you're constantly in your head. But then in that fixation, you accidentally dissociate almost. You irrelevantize your earth identity, and that isn't what it's about either. That, you know, it's fusing that, it's the two are the same thing, and figuring out a way to recognize that. I have no idea how to do that.
Yeah, well, you can transform. That's what's amazing. You can, like, all the, you know, the energy and the enthusiasm and passion that you have for things, you can transform that all into your meditation practice. You know,
right.
And it doesn't have to, it doesn't negate it. You're just taking like those aspects of yourself and you're kind of bridling it. You know, that's what yoga is. You're yoking yourself to God. Yug, you know, that's what it means. You're connecting, and you can connect with that.
Poison into medicine. It's like this is the other thing that keeps coming up in this book. It's a very compassionate book. It's so good, you guys. It's, from confusion into turning confusion into clarity, but
what you just did.
it's whatever the thing is you're hung up on. You know, initially when you start meditating, at least in this form of Buddhism, you use your breath as the object of awareness. So you're putting your awareness on your breath initially. But later on, it's like if you're having some neurotic issue or whatever, resistance, aversion to the practice or whatever, make the aversion the object of awareness instead of your breath. So now place your awareness on the aversion, place your awareness on the seeming obstacle, and just that alone transforms the obstacle into fuel for your practice, wood for your cremation god, so to speak.
Amazing. That's all. Yeah, fuel for the fire.
One day I hope we get to go to Varanasi, man. That will be so fun.
We're going. It's just, I don't know when, but it's going to happen. I can see
open a little together. Wood stand, start yep. selling wood at Varanasi together, retire to Varanasi, sell wood.
That's my goal. That's to be there at the end. So maybe you'll come visit me when I'm on the pyre.
Cause you kind of need, I would, but you kind of, but you know, for the sake of your family, you do kind of need to get out there before you die. Cause then they've got to deal with getting a coffin to India. That can't be easy.
Yeah. Man. You have to die there.
Oh, really? You can't ship a coffin in?
Good luck. Maybe you can. I don't know. But
good luck.
Shipping a book to India is difficult sometimes. Getting a full body there, I'm not sure if you're able. Or getting no, a living body there is a hard enough task.
your corpse is going to end up in like New Delhi. Like, it's never going to make it.
Stuck in customs.
Well, where can everyone is going to want this deck now? Where can we get it?
Well, I'm going to send you the link for it's at Raking Light Projects is the company that the great company that handles all my who did my last book and all my prints and they did this deck. So we'll make a link for it. You can get the book and the deck, or you can just get the deck if you're familiar and you just read things your own way. For me, I made the book so it corresponds with each card.
So the book is the interpretation of each. Yeah. Okay, great. Okay, and, good. You're going to need that. Don't do that. I think you need the artist's interpretation of the cards if you're going to do any kind of real reading. I mean, I like the idea of like deciding what it means, but it really, as you can see from just our conversation, there's so much you're going to miss in any given tarot card that might add to your understanding of some situation that you're going through.
Yeah. So Raking Light Projects is where to get the cards and the decks. So you can get them together. There's a package. And if you act now, you can get a tote bag with it for free. So.
Ooh, I love a good tote bag.
Who doesn't?
I love my tote. Everyone loves totes. All right. Thank you. So Robert, you are the best, man. Thank you so much.
What a great conversation. Thank you so much. I love it.
My pleasure. Hare Krishna.
Hare Bol.
That was Robert Ryan, everybody. If you want to order his tarot deck, you can find the links at duncantrussell.com. A tremendous thank you to our sponsors. Thank you for listening. Let me know what you think about my Instagram shift. Is it crazy? Is it crazy? What am I doing? Or is it good? I don't know. Let me know. I'll see you guys out there on the road, and I'll see you next week. Until then, Hare Krishna.